So Seth, I first came across your work about 7 years ago. I was working as a bicycle messenger in Belfast and I wasn't creating anything. I had all these ideas and I was like, yeah, one day. I was just consuming. And I also felt like I had zero time. And I was listening to podcasts all day while I was cycling around the city. And I heard you on Tim Ferriss one day and you talked about this one big decision that freed up something like upwards of 100 hours per month. And I remember being like, this is the key that I'm looking for. Could you tell us what that decision was and what led to you making it?
First of all, thank you for showing up the way you do. It is great to have the privilege to talk to you. You're a creator now, and we live in a system that pushes people and indoctrinates people to take things as they're offered and to consume them. And, you know, people say to me, you must be really busy. And I'm not that busy. And part of the reason is I don't go to meetings. I don't use Facebook. I don't use Twitter. I don't use LinkedIn. And I don't watch television. When you make a vivid decision like that, it's part of a strategy of how you're going to show up in the world as opposed to simply taking what's convenient. And by freeing up all of that time, I mean, just meetings alone, you know, if someone can send me a memo, you better send me a memo, because if it's something that we could cover in a memo, I'm not going to stick around the meeting. That just adds days to your month, years to your life. But the reason it's hard is because then you're on the hook to actually do something with the time you free up.
Yeah, and I think that's the scary bit. I remember whenever we made the decision, we decided not to get a TV. And then you have those evenings where you're just sitting there and you're kind of looking at each other. You're like, okay, well, now what? And it is, you're on the hook, because then it's like, all right, bucko, what are you going to do now? You wanted all this time. Now you've got this time. What next?
Exactly. And so, you know, it's hard for people of your generation to imagine a world where there were three TV channels. There were a dozen magazines that had a big impact. You couldn't speak up, even if you wanted to. You couldn't have your own podcast. You couldn't have your own YouTube channel. You couldn't have your own whatever it is you're going to produce for the world. And now anyone can. There's 4 billion people with a smartphone. All of them have the same tools as you and me.
So once you solve the time problem, the next thing to solve is, okay, well, what are you actually going to create? And there's 2 questions that you ask throughout your work, and it features quite a lot in This Is Marketing, that helps us get clear on who it is we're trying to serve and what it is we're trying to do with them. So we'd love to kind of dive into that a little bit more.
Yeah, well, design thinking is super simple, but sounds complicated. Whatever you do that interacts with any other human has only 2 questions: who's it for and what's it for? Because it can't be for everyone. There's nothing for everyone. Who exactly are you seeking to serve, to change, to influence, to make a difference for? And what is the change you seek to make? And acknowledging that that is the purpose of the work is really challenging, because then you're on the hook. Because if you say, I made it for Bob and Bob doesn't like it, you didn't do a good job. If you said, I made it for Bob and the goal is to do this and it doesn't do that, you didn't do a good job. But that seems like a great opportunity to me, to be able to learn what a not great job is and be able to do it better.
So for people who have no idea what tribe they want to serve, you know, they're in that kind of exploration phase of either their business or their practice. What kind of guiding questions would you put to them to help them on their way?
Well, the thing that holds most people back is this fear of making the audience we're serving as small as possible, not as big as possible, because that's what we see in the media. You want to, you know, get a TikTok that gets seen by 60 million people. You want to make it as small as you can get by with, because that is achievable, but that also opens the door to be on the hook. So, you know, the glasses that I'm wearing right now aren't for everyone. And that's exactly why they're for me, because they're for someone. And figuring out the smallest, most particular group of people that you can reach out to and say, here, I made this. We can practice that, because you only need 5 to get started. Who are the 5 people that if they read your poem would say, this poem made a difference. I would miss it if you stopped doing this. If there aren't five people, then you got to come up with a better shtick.
You have a great book called Tribes, and one of my favorite phrases, and I've used this. I feel like I owe you hundreds of thousands of dollars for the amount of things I've plagiarized with clients and customers over the years.
I owe you for that. If the idea spread, I win. Yes.
You've got this lovely phrase called shunning the non-believers. That's courageous, and I love that. Tell us a bit more.
Well, you know, I haven't read a review on Amazon of any of my work for the last dozen years. And the reason is because I've never met an author who said, I read all my one-star reviews and now I'm a better writer. That's not going to happen. What a one-star review tells you is something about the reader, right? If all the reviews are one-star reviews, that's different. But if you got five-star reviews on anything you make and you see a one-star review, all that one-star review says is, this wasn't for me. Okay, great. I got it. It wasn't for you. Thanks for letting me know. But I don't need to read why it wasn't for you, because you're a non-believer. You don't get the joke. Okay, fine. And if I'm a stand-up comic and the audience only speaks Italian, I'm not going to beat myself up for my timing or my jokes because they don't speak English. It's not for them. And I'm not saying we don't respect and admire the people who aren't in our audience. What I'm saying is, your work has to be for someone. And if you can put yourself on the hook to actually make something worthwhile for them, then you stop hustling people and you stop hassling people, because the hustle always comes from people who are making average stuff for average people and are running out of average people to make it for.
And so why do you think we as entrepreneurs, not all of us, but a vast majority of us, particularly when we start off, we try to bend over backwards to try to get people into the community or try to get the invoice signed? Is it a lack of courage? Is it a lack of conviction on our own part? Like, what's going on there?
You know, and I think this gets back to Belfast a little bit. We become who we are surrounded by. And so if you're going out on a limb doing something new in the first place, becoming an entrepreneur in the first place, and then you ask people for insight or advice, a lot of these people care about you and they don't want you to be hurt. So they will tell you to do less, to scale it back, to make it more boring, to make it more average. You shouldn't be listening to those people. And, you know, if you grow up in a household where it is normal to produce, to create, to lead, you're more likely to do those things. And so tribal culture, the culture of the clan and the village, that informs a lot of what we do. So Silicon Valley doesn't work because it's a special place. It works because they've attracted people who want to do a thing. And you can find those circles anywhere because now we're all connected online. You can listen to podcasts featuring those people. You can model everything you're doing and get feedback from those people and ignore the people who are looking out for you but are misguided.
We have our podcast studio in a really special co-working space in Belfast city centre. It's called Ormo Baths. It's like an old Victorian bathhouse. It's where like Victorian factory workers would come to get washed like three times a year or whatever it was. Now it's this entrepreneurial hub. It's really interesting. You see a shift happen in people's heads whenever they come in because they're like, oh, I'm surrounded by other like-minded people. Maybe for the first time, people who aren't encouraging me to become, you know, a doctor or a lawyer or get a job with the government or whatever the accountancy kind of model is, it just gives them such a sense of energy. And as you say, you can do that physically or now, thanks to the internet, you can do that digitally, which is super cool.
Yeah. And it's not, I'm not encouraging you to do it for 5 minutes a day. I'm encouraging you to immerse yourself in it. The baths is a great metaphor for that, right? But when we talk about who we're becoming, you know, I built this community called purple.space and we've got people in 40 countries who are in it 24 hours a day. It's the opposite of Facebook. It's just the right people. No one's hassling. No one's hustling. No one is hurting anybody else. It is simply a group of people who want to be there to raise the bar for other people. And if you spend enough time in a world like that, you will become more like the person you want to be.
Yeah, I remember over COVID, you launched this thing called Kimbo Coworking Space.
Yeah.
And it was the first online community I remember being a part of. And it was at such a crazy moment in history. And everyone was kind of coming together like, what the heck's going on? How are we going to pivot? And there's just this, I've never experienced energy like it that wasn't in person.
Yeah.
What do you think it takes to build a successful online community in your experience?
The incentives are the first step. You need to be incented to be selective about who's there and how they behave. You need to have a incentive to kick people out. You need to be able to say any community online or off is the same, which is the people you let into your pub will determine who's going to come to your pub next and what's it like around here. So that's been the biggest advantage that I've had in building communities is I've never had an advertiser. Because if you have an advertiser, they want you to have as many people as possible and they want you to interrupt them as often as possible and get them to click as often as possible, right? And I want to do all the opposite of those things. And so incentives is the first step. And then the second step is convenience isn't the point. The point is change and connection.
You have this amazing program called the Alt MBA. And when I first came across it, you know, maybe 3 years in my business journey, I was like, what a load of nonsense. It's like, how can you possibly like transform as a person by being part of an online thing? And I was just like, I love his books, but this thing here, I don't get it. How do you bring about results and change in that intense type online community environment?
Business school is about getting a piece of paper accreditation. It is no longer about learning the stuff because the stuff is all online for free. That in, you know, a few weeks of very focused study, you could learn everything they teach you about the stuff in 2 years of business school. That's not what business school does. Business school is this cultural indoctrination into what it's like to be that kind of leader. And they waste an enormous amount of time. And there's a lot of reasons for that. So the idea of the Alt MBA was, I said, there are all these new tools built. If I didn't care about accreditation, if I didn't care about maximizing the things that typical universities care about, what would I build and how would I make it work in this form? And so the idea of being in a cohort of 5 people and 12 people and 100 people and being on the hook and shipping work every day for 30 days and getting direct feedback and giving direct feedback and having this safe place where you can adopt a new persona and do it with enrollment on purpose with high stakes for 30 days and then done. It turns out people take off a lot of armor when they get there. And if you can add direct coaching to it, what I was able to do was build a thing that restructured a lot of instincts that people had. So real MBAs change lives because for the rest of your life, you have a badge that other people recognize. The Alt MBA changes lives because you see somebody different in the mirror when you're done.
Mm. And I have to say, out of all the things that I've been able to learn from your work over the years, developing that practice of constantly shipping work, I think has been the most powerful thing. Like I said to you in the email to set this conversation up, that, you know, we've been going for 7 years on this specific podcast and we haven't missed a Monday. And that commitment in and of itself, it's the thing that's brought about the most transformation in my life, if I really reflect on it. So why are we afraid to ship work? And why is it powerful to ship something every day?
Well, as my friend Zig used to say, it's a little like showering, which is doing it every day is a fine idea, right? You don't do it once and get it over with. Why is it so difficult? For 15,000 years, as we evolved as a human species, we were in groups and tribes and cadres of up to 150 people. And if you offended the chief, if you spoke up too much, if you were annoying, you were left out of the circle. And if you were left out of the circle, you're going to get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. And so deep down, built into our culture, is this idea that you need to chill and do what you're told. And it's interesting because the internet gave everyone a microphone, and the people who use it the most are annoying trolls. They're people who find pleasure in hurting other people. And that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is the generative network effect that comes when a good-hearted soul seeks to make somebody else's life better. And why wouldn't we do that every day? We eat lunch every day. And once you do it every day, then it becomes a habit. Once it becomes a habit, it becomes who you are.
Yeah. And I've, experimented with lots of different rhythms, weekly, daily, monthly, et cetera, et cetera. And I just find when you're in the daily rhythm, it's such a gift to yourself, because I don't know if you would call this being on the hook, but it changes the way I experience my day-to-day life.
Yes.
It forces my brain to be looking for, oh, and like, what's the insight there? What's like the nuance there? That's really interesting. How would I turn this into a blog post, or how would I turn this into a podcast, et cetera?
Exactly.
Et cetera. It's actually a lovely thing.
Yeah. No, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And if you're a creator, everything looks like something to think about.
Everything's just raw material to make art from then at that point, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think, the Belfast mentality is, there's a lot of fear, and there's a lot of reasons for why that is. There's a lot of, I don't want to share the thing that I have because I'm afraid the people will criticize. And if they criticize it, I think they're criticizing me. And if they criticize me, then I'm going to be very sad. What would you say to the would-be creator, the would-be artist who's struggling with that?
Well, the first thing is, there's a difference between our narrative and reality.
Right.
Right? If you've been to a little village that has no electricity and no healthcare, you would realize how wealthy every single person in Belfast is. And if you think about the trauma that you would experience if your work actually totally failed, it's tiny compared to actual trauma.
Right.
And so we have invented this narrative. Now, Belfast has a history of using it as fuel, because some of the greatest creators of all time have come from Belfast. So if it's working for you as fuel, go for it. And if it's not working for you as fuel, then why do you keep adding it to your narrative? Right? The fact is, you don't get tomorrow over again. You get tomorrow once. So how do you want to spend it? What story do you want to tell yourself when you wake up? And what story do you want to tell yourself when you go to sleep? And the fact is, if you are dry and healthy and warm, you have an enormous amount of freedom. You're not trying to go pick some berries and feed your family. Okay, great. So you've got, let's just say we're going to do this one evening a week, one day a week, right? You're not at work. What are you going to do now? And the idea that you're going to ship a tiny, tiny piece of contribution to a tiny, tiny group of people, that shouldn't be scary.
I think as well, it's wrapped up in this narrative that, as soon as I publish my thing, like millions of people are going to see it. Whereas the reality is, it's like, I'm sorry, man, but like, you might not know this, but the biggest threat you're going to face is invisibility.
There are plenty of people in my life who I'm very close with who don't read my work. It's like, it's out there, but maybe they read it. Maybe, it doesn't matter. Just start. And if you need to, this is a really good hack. Do it under another name. Make a podcast. It's podcast. No one can see you on a podcast. Make a podcast and don't put your real name on it. Figure out how to have a blog without somebody else, with somebody else's name on it. Just be in the world. And the worst thing will happen is you walk away from it.
Yeah. And you talked about kind of tribes and online tribes earlier. It is funny. Even talking to the guys in Normal Bass, they're like, what are you doing today? And it's like, well, actually, like, this is really amazing. I'm talking to Seth. And some of them were like, who? And other people were like, oh yeah, I love his books. That's amazing. And it must be funny for you and anyone who serves a specific niche where, as you say, there's people in your life, they've probably never read your book. They don't really care. But you get to live out this very, very generous experience where you get to serve lots and lots of people as you have through your work. Make an impact on their lives, but still function as an ordinary husband and dad and community member of where you live, I assume.
I am lucky enough to have some very successful, very famous friends. I have no desire to have to deal with that, right? And I'm also lucky enough to have enough in the bank that I don't have to worry about putting dinner on the table. That's magic, just the right amount. and it's available to more people because the smallest viable audience is there. You can find them.
Tim Ferriss had a great thing a few years ago where he's like, everyone wants to be rich and famous. I would suggest just trying to be rich first. And then I think the way we could reframe that is just try to impact 1,000 people's lives and then see where that takes you. You don't need to worry about the next step.
Yeah. No, that was Bill Murray, one of the smartest things he ever said.
What did he say? Is that where that came from?
The first half. Bill Murray did the first half about the rich and famous part. Tim's addition makes perfect sense, right? Which is 1,000 true fans, as Kevin Kelly has written, is a lot. And even people who think they have 1,000 true fans don't, because a true fan is willing to drive across the country to support you, is willing to subscribe to your new service without knowing what it is. And if you can get 10 of those, that's huge. Because to get 10 of those, you got to find 1,000 people who trust you and 10,000 people who consume your work. Great. Go start with that.
Who has helped you along your way? Like, who were some of your mentors, either physical or, I'm not going to say digital, but non-physical, mm-hmm. people's work that you consume, books that you read, tapes that you listened to? Who were some of those people?
Lots of people have been seduced into thinking they need a mentor. And if you do any math at all, you'll see it doesn't scale because it's an asymmetrical relationship. Heroes, on the other hand, scale great because the Mahatma, Nelson Mandela, make a long list. They will never meet you, but you can ask yourself, what would they do, right? What would Madame Curie do? And finding heroes is a really seductive and useful way to spend your time. Sometimes you'll meet them, and I've been lucky enough to actually work with some of my heroes, but you don't need to because they'll probably disappoint you, which is one reason why if someone says, can we have lunch? I always say no, because I end up disappointing people. The Zig Ziglar definitely saved my career. He passed away a few years ago. He was my friend. He was my teacher. I published his work. And his stuff's a little dated, but I strongly recommend spending 30, 40 hours listening to, for example, Secrets of Closing the Sale. But mostly, I would say I have learned from people like you, that it's the people who have read my work closely and interact with me, who go into the world and do things, that's when I learn. Because I see at scale what is and isn't actual. And people who are generous and who are willing to speak up about what they're doing and how they do it, I find that wildly inspiring.
It's crazy, even just this little podcast, very, very niche, about Northern Ireland. You know, I probably blame you for niching down so hard after reading Tribes or something like that. And it felt really risky. It felt very, very scary. And it has been the most unbelievable experience of my life to, you know, connect with lots of people from Belfast who are living all around the world. Like, they come crawling out of the woodworks. And it's funny how just kind of like, you know, picking that one specific city.
Right.
Seth, the things are mad. Like, and I share this just to kind of give you a bit of a fruit of your work type thing. It's like people have moved to Northern Ireland after listening to the stories. People have set up businesses in Northern Ireland after listening to the stories. People have, you know, made massive, massive decisions. They've started businesses. They've, you know, changed careers. They've X, Y, and Z. And I think it's just really exciting that's the power of the niche and that's the power of the tribe.
You know, you're showing up with a consistent voice. And I'm not going to say you have magical talent because I don't have it and probably neither do you. You have skill. And I haven't listened to your first episode, but I'm guessing it's not as good as the recent ones. Skill is something we get from practice.
I think our first episode took us like 30 hours to make, you know, and this episode here, which is one of the most, you know, exciting conversations in our podcast in history, it'll take us about half an hour. Do you know what I mean? So it's funny how the further you get along in your practice, the more joy it is. And I think your audience feels that as well. They're like, oh, okay, it's episode 150. He's starting to have fun now.
Yeah.
What was it about Zig? How did Zig save your career?
So after I went out on my own, I was a book packager. I came up with ideas and sold them to book publishers. And I got 800 rejection letters in a row. That's a lot. And I was failing and there was a lot of pressure to give up. And Zig pioneered the idea of the motivational speaker. He pioneered the idea of the cassette tapes. And he said, you need to listen 8 times, 10 times. So I had 72 hours of tapes. I listened to them so many times that I had to buy a new set because I broke the old ones. And I used to be able to do his stories word for word. And the reason that that was useful is because when you confronted something that was going to cause you to give up, his voice was there, not mine. His voice was there. And Zig was the one who was responding to the objections and the rejections, not me. And he didn't have anything personal at stake because I'd never met him. He's just in there, the stories, right? I got the money right here with the guy with the overalls and the pots and pan sets and the car, the old car, and the, you know, I still remember so much of it. And listening to it now, there's nothing incredibly profound in it. If you ask ChatGPT to summarize the 20 top bullet points, you learn nothing. It's the mantra of it. And I think mantras matter a lot.
Your latest book, Song of Significance, it talks a lot about the difference between leadership and management. Our government in Northern Ireland, they're very often not even in office. They like strike and they go off and it's this and it's that. And there's a real lack of leadership. And the people who are really leading the city are, they're the entrepreneurs. They're the makers. They're the creators. They're the artists. They're the street traders, the bakers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Could you just break down like how you think about leadership versus management?
Government's main job is to manage. And I think most times, if there isn't a cataclysm or a war, that's what government does, is they manage. Manage is use power and authority to get expected results. And we want the streets to be swept and the parking to be regulated and the water to be clean. That's a management task. Leadership is voluntary. Leadership says, I'm going over there. Who wants to come? Leadership says, here's a problem that hasn't been solved yet. Let's come up with some interesting ways to solve it that might not work. And creators have to lead because you can't manage your way to a great jazz record. You can't manage your way to a story that changes someone's life, right? And so James Joyce was probably an absolutely terrible manager of everything, but he figured out how to lead literature for a generation. And so the idea, and I know it's not Belfast, but it's still in my head, it's Ireland.
That's okay. We like try to claim everyone as our own anyway, so it's all good. We got C.S. Lewis and Seamus Heaney. That's okay. We're good.
So, you know, the opportunity we have is to realize that Narnia wasn't the first thing C.S. Lewis ever wrote. The first thing he ever wrote was a laundry list when he was 12 years old. That there is a skill involved in leadership. This cycle that we go through to get from here to there. That we have to have a strategy, that we need to find a path. And you will never get there unless you start.
What do you have to say about this post-COVID? You have to return to work. We're going to log your keystrokes. We're going to make sure that you're doing your 39.5 hours every single week. What's that going to lead to and what's the alternative?
Well, I think it's you have to return to your job, not you have to return to work, right? And the work is leadership. The work is solving interesting problems. The job is compliance. If you want compliance, it's unbelievable how many, since I was born, the planet has invented 4 billion jobs. There are 4 billion people at work who didn't have a job in 1960. So that's a miracle that you can trade your time for money and healthcare and food. And if that's what you want, please go do that. But to be alive and to be a contribution, you're going to have to do work, not your job. And that means if someone's already written down the steps, you can do better than that. And there's a great expression I just learned in Russian. I will not say it in Russian. I'll tell you the literal translation. Office plankton. Office plankton is the class of people who go to work having completely surrendered agency and autonomy and just do what they're told. And I just don't think you want to be an office plankton.
I don't think anybody listening wants to be an office plankton, Sav. So what's next for you? There seems to be a pulling back. So it doesn't seem like you're traveling as much. Seems like you're doing fewer course and things like that. What's your song of significance for the next, let's say, the next decade?
Well, once I figure that out, I'll tell myself first. It is true. I don't fly for work anymore ever since I did the climate book, the Carbon Almanac. So I do lots of virtual stuff. You just don't notice because I'm doing it virtually. I felt like the Akimbo courses established a standard, and I eagerly helped other people copy those ideas. And so I'm focusing on a software project we're launching in a couple months. I'm focusing on doing my writing every day and just establishing that it's okay to have a space and to find space to figure out where the light gets in and what to do next.
As you said at the very top of the call, you don't have to be busy to make an impact. And so I'm excited to see what you're putting out every single day. And I'm also excited to see what you're cooking up next. Seth, thank you so much for your time. Genuinely, the first business-related piece of content I ever consumed was the Startup School. I don't even know when that was recorded or who recorded that. I have the phrase Earwolf in my head because they have some sort of jingle in the middle of it. Yeah. But genuinely, thank you so much for how you've shown up and for the incredible work and the generous work that you've created for all of us and for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Keep making a ruckus. Belfast needs you and so do the rest of us.
Thanks, Seth.